Morning, everyone. I now call the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bo.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Igo present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Mecklund.
Mecklund present.
Representative Munson. Representative Munson. Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson.
All right. We have a quorum, members. We have five bills up today. The let's see, I think we might have to switch up the order because we were first going to take up Representative Stevenson's bill, but I'm not seeing him here yet, so I'm sure he will be here shortly. So we will go ahead and move on to the second bill on the agenda, which is House File 3614. And since this is my bill and Vice Chair Akam is here with us, perhaps I'll let her take the gavel and we can go from there.
Great. Mr. Chair, would you like to move your bill?
Sure. So I'm going to move House File 3614 be laid over for possible inclusion.
And the bill is nice move. So, okay, so I'm being caught off guard. I'm not finding myself in my little script here. So, Mr. Chair, would you like to go ahead and tell us about your bill?
I do. I have an amendment. So if it's okay with the chair, I'll move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for moving the A1. Any discussion on the amendment?
I'll just explain it briefly, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Yes, absolutely.
So this is just to put in to fill in the blank that is currently in the bill for the amount that we're talking about for the purposes of acquisition cost limit and adding in $500,000.
Any discussion from members on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Seeing none, the amendment is adopted and the bill is in the shape the author would like. Would you like to go ahead and tell us about your bill?
Be happy to. So this bill is, I think, a pretty common sense update to the current requirement that we have around when public utility is required to go to the PUC to get approval for disposing of a piece of property and what the threshold is for that. And the threshold currently is $100,000, which was set sometime in the 70s. And so we haven't really updated the law since then. This would increase it to $500,000, which would essentially be updating for inflation. And so that is the current proposal. I think there are three individuals who are here to testify about the bill.
Great. First up, we have Mr. Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Please go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Chair Long has taken three quarters of my outline explaining the bill, which of course I expected he would do. As I'm sure the committee can imagine, something that cost $100,000 in 1974, when I believe this provision was adopted, now covers things like bucket trucks and single transformers, which don't have any real impact on customers and don't really require PUC approval. We buy and sell a lot of things during the course of a year, and if they get over that threshold, then of course we have to take time to make a filing with the PUC, and they have to take time to analyze the filing and have a hearing and all of that. And it, you know, we're always looking for ways to try to expedite matters of greater importance at the PUC, and this goes a long way towards accomplishing that. So we are very much supportive of the bill and believe it's a good update to the current statute.
Great, thank you. And next up we have Mr. Will Seifert with the Public Utility Commission. Mr. Seifert, please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Will Seifert, Executive Secretary, Public Utilities Commission. The commission doesn't have a position on the bill before you. It would have a ceiling for requiring advanced commission approval of a purchase or sale of a utility plant. The underlying issue is not whether the commission eventually gets to determine whether the purchase or sale of the plant is prudent. That happens in rate cases, rider filings, or other related dockets, but whether it needs to do so in advance of the purchase or sale. Apart from the statute, utilities may also ask for approval of investments and expenditures outside of a rate case in order to include it in rider. For something important to the operating system in Minnesota, it makes sense to require advanced approval at some level to ensure your utility is not giving away important plant that ratepayers have paid for and that is not paying too much for a purchase of a plant, as current law does. However, the threshold of of 100,000 hasn't changed since it was enacted in 1974, as the author noted, therefore not accounting for inflation, as was mentioned, accounting for general inflation from 1974 through 2022 would result in 100,000 being approximately 500,000. Another thing the committee may want to consider is, depending on the level they choose to set the threshold for pre-approval, the impact on customers will vary across utility service territories. For example, a $1 million purchase will impact Otter Tail's customers at a higher percentage than a $1 million purchase will impact Xcel's customers. For additional perspective, I pulled some preliminary numbers from the last 10 years for dockets on plant sales or purchase. There were about 15 dockets relating to plant sales or acquisitions. Four of them were interrelated, filed between 2014 and 2020. A quick scan found that three of them involved less than $500,000, and one was right around $1 million. The rest were significantly over $1 million. There are also currently two pending property acquisition dockets before the commission involving this section of law. While I can't discuss the merits, I do want to call these to your attention to help illustrate the issues before you. 22-101 involves Xcel Energy's planned sale of transformers valued around $1.5 million. And 21-793 involves Otter Tail Power's planned acquisition of some of the Ashtabula wind farm exceeding $50 million in costs. As I previously noted, the agency doesn't have a position on the bill, but is happy to answer any questions and wanted to provide a little bit of extra background and context. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Seifert, for your testimony. And we have just one more testifier, and then we'll get to questions, Representative Swazinski. Next up, we have Annie Levinson-Falk with the Citizens Utility Board. Go ahead and present your testimony for the committee.
Thank you, Chair Akam. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk, and I'm the Executive Director of the Nonprofit Citizens Utility Board. I've been asked for Cubs thoughts on this bill, both in the House and the Senate, so thank you for allowing me to share just a few thoughts today. I certainly agree with everyone who's spoken that it makes sense to increase the threshold from $100,000. I think everybody knows $100,000 isn't verified nearly as much, especially in the scale of utility investments today, and it's just not a good use of the utility's time or the commission's time or anyone's to be looking into that level of detail. I don't know if Xcel or other utilities have specific plans other than what Mr. Seifert outlined, where this threshold might come into play, but I've thought about it in terms of what it might mean for customers. Of course, Xcel being by far the largest utility in the state can absorb a pretty large purchase without it making an impact on customers' bills. On the other hand, as Mr. Seifert said, increasing the threshold could get to have a substantial impact on bills for some of the smaller utilities, the customers of the smaller utilities. And the way that I've been looking at it is to look at it as a percentage of the utility's total annual revenues. Or another way to look at that is the percent that rates might have to go up to account for utility purchasing something at that threshold if it were to happen in the year. So if the threshold increases to 500,000 as is in the DE, it'd be a minuscule rate increase for Xcel. And on the other end of the scale, looking at Otter Tail Power, which is the smallest investor-owned utility in the state, it'd be about a quarter of a percent rate increase if that were to happen in a year. So you can see how if it gets to be larger amounts, that could start to add up for customers of the smaller utilities. And as I said, I certainly agree that increasing the threshold for PUC approval makes sense. And as the bill moves forward and the threshold level, I think maybe continuing to be negotiated, I just encourage you to keep in mind the impact that it might have on utility customers and particularly the different scale of the impact it could have for utilities of different sizes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I see that Representative Swazinski has a question. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This would be a question to the folks from the utility, whichever that might be. Just a general question on, you know, what is your request in this bill, $500,000? Is that what you're asking for as far as an exemption, or did you ask for a different amount? That's my first question.
Madam Chair, you know, we frankly, XL Energy would have liked a higher level. I think as both Mr. Seifert and Ms. Falk have testified, you know, it's a different impact on a company our size versus a smaller company. So we would you know, we would like to see it for us at least the level somewhat higher, but we primarily want to seek consensus on this, you know, any increases and improvement. And so just in listening to the testimony, I've got, you know, a couple of ideas of, you know, perhaps some way we could even change the bill before it gets to the omnibus bill and see if we can reach some consensus. But, you know, we're very happy to have the fivefold increase that's proposed in the bill, and we'll see if we can build consensus for a higher amount. One of the things, just since Mr. Seifert mentioned it, it's kind of interesting. The sale that he noted was $1.5 million is actually the sale of 139 individual transformers. They happen to be very valuable right now because supply chain has made used transformers very valuable. So we would like to get that sale done. Obviously, any one of those transformers is far below even the current limit, but we're selling them as a package because we think we're getting a better price. So that, you know, I just raised that as, you know, another sort of interesting way these things can come up, and maybe we can find some further relief there. But we're very appreciative of Representative Long bringing the bill. We're very appreciative of increasing the limit, and we'd like to have some further discussions about whether there's some other things we can do to relieve the number of dockets that need to be filed.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Representative Swazinski, did you have follow-up?
Yeah, just in my follow-up is just to Mr. Seifert from the PUC. Mr. Seifert, just as a percentage of workload, what percentage of the workload, maybe you kind of covered this a little bit, but what percentage are these types of decisions to be made? And does the PUC have a history of rejecting any of these requests?
Mr. Seifert.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I'll do those backwards. As I say, just a quick scan of dockets over the last decade. The only one that was rejected was the Xcel's proposed purchase of the Mankato Energy Center. And certainly that's well above the threshold contemplated before you in this bill. As it relates to workload, you know, as I noted, of about 15 dockets, three of them would probably fall in the area of 100,000 to a half million. So that's not a particularly significant amount of work. So it would be hard to project savings. You know, theoretically, if it would reduce our docket workload, certainly would reduce, staff time spent on this, but it's really, we don't have a crystal ball, so we don't really know what's reasonable to forecast in terms of what utilities are going to bring forward going forward.
Any additional follow-up, Representative Swazinski?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion by members? Representative Swazinski, oh, no, maybe it went down. Representative Long, would you like to close?
Sure. Thank you. I just appreciate the discussion on this bill and look forward to continued engagement on it, and appreciate folks coming to testify on the bill today.
Great. Seeing nothing else, Representative Long renews his motion that House File 3614 be laid over. The bill is laid over. And I will gladly pass the gavel back to Chair Long.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Akam. So we are going to bring up House File 3151, Representative Stevenson's bill. Would you care to move your bill, Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move, and I'm sorry I misplaced my sheet here with the number, so if you can remind me.
3151.
House File 3151, and I believe I'm moving it to the General Register.
My understanding is it's going to Judiciary.
I got a text this morning indicating otherwise. I don't know if Mr. Mull's on.
Mr. Molzan currently believes Judiciary, but why don't we hear the bill and we'll get the motion right by the end of it.
Okay, sounds good. Mr. Chair, I also do believe I have a DE amendment.
Yes. Would you like to move your amendment?
I would move the DE amendment.
Anything you'd like to say about it?
This just gets the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider it in after some conversations with staff at the PUC to better reflect a workable practice for them.
Great. Any discussion to the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill is a consumer protection bill. Essentially, Minnesota is an extreme outlier in that we have no way for an individual consumer who has a dispute with a utility to get in front of the full commission, the full PUC, and thus without that, they have no way of getting in front of a judge. A law provides that you have to be in a group of 50 similarly situated people right now in order to get full committee commission action. And without full commission action, there's no way to get to the PUC or to the courts. If you feel you've been wronged by utility, either in the way they've denied you service or you've had a billing dispute or something else. So the bill tries to formalize a process. Currently, the PUC does handle these cases internally with excellent staff work. And we're just trying to formalize that and create a pathway so that if somebody is dissatisfied with that they have continued recourse. Mr. Chair, I believe I have Mr. Elwood here to explain the bill further, and I'm happy to answer questions after that.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And sorry about the referral. I had tried to ferret out if it needed to go to Judiciary. I hadn't heard that, so obviously I apologize for any confusion. First of all, I want to thank the PUC, Will Seifert and Ryan Barlow, and also want to thank all of the utility companies, Xcel and Rick Evans. I think he's still on the call or on the in the hearing. CenterPoint, Minnesota Power, Otter Tail, and all of the co-ops and munis. We vetted this bill with all of them. They have been very kind to have no concerns about the bill, gave us a couple of technical suggestions, which are reflected in the amendment. And the majority of the amendment is a result of the PUC's technical assistance to us, as Chair Stevens has said, to make sure that this works with their internal process. Very simply, this bill fills a gap in Minnesota law, and it establishes this process by which a residential consumer who makes an informal complaint to the PUC staff, who generally able to resolve almost all of them, most of them, and so are the utilities. I want to make that clear. The utilities and the PUC staff do an excellent job of working with consumers and resolving complaints. But there are complaints that raise important issues of law, potential misinterpretation of law or violation of law, rule, tariff. There are acts and practices which ought to be before the commission if they cannot be resolved. And this creates a process by which it can get there. As Representative Stevenson's, Chair Stevenson said, Minnesota is the only state in America, including the District of Columbia, where a residential customer does not have a statutory right to appeal to the commission regarding a complaint that's not statutorily resolved at the informal level. I would also say in that, first of all, the bill applies to public investor utilities, investor-owned utilities only. It does not apply to municipal and cooperative utilities. And the bill applies only to residential customer complaints. We also have great support and appreciative of that from the Citizens Utility Board. You have a letter in your packets. Energy Sense Coalition and the Minnesota Community Action Partnership are also supporters, and we have heard no concerns. I think I'll just stop there and answer any questions that people have. I did one last thing. I think one question that'll invariably arise is the first question that we asked when we contemplated, you know, bringing this to Chair Stevenson was, well, is this going to create a burdensome situation for the PUC or the utilities where there's going to be, you know, a whole ton of these kinds of complaints coming to the commission, and is it going to overwhelm staff resources? And we are confident that that is not going to be the case for a whole variety of reasons. First of all, as I said before, the utilities and the PUC do a really good job of trying to resolve customer complaints in the first place. The second reason is that if we look at the definition in the bill of what a complaint is, I mean, it has to raise a serious issue of a violation of a law, rule, tariff, or some kind of a practice. It does not apply to telephone complaints and all of the unregulated complaints. And third of all, every state in the union has this. Before I came to Minnesota, I was on staff at a large utility commission back east, and with significantly more customers than in Minnesota. And this process was there, and it did not overwhelm the commission. It hasn't overwhelmed any commission in any state. And these processes have been in place for a significant amount of time across the country. So with that, I'll stand for questions and say thank you to all the stakeholders for their help in getting this bill to where it is.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. And I believe that Mr. Seifert is also here to speak to the bill as well. Mr. Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Will Seifert, Executive Secretary of PUC, thanks again for the invitation to come in and make comments on this bill. I also want to thank the author and Legal Aid for reaching out to us beforehand and your willingness to work with us to try to better understand how our processes could be shaped by the proposed law. The commission hasn't taken a formal position on the underlying bill. The chair is supportive of the intent and direction of the bill and has instructed staff to work with the bill authors on the administrative details of the legislation, which is reflected in the amendment before the committee. We appreciate the author's efforts to update the commission statute pertaining to consumer disputes and establish a streamlined procedure for commission disposition and judicial review in instances where a singular consumer may not be satisfied with the resolution of his or her dispute. Under current law, a formal complaint may be initiated by any political subdivision, by another public utility, by the department, by any 50 consumers, or by the commission's own action. This legislation creates a specific pathway for individual complainants to get a decision from the commission about their specific complaint and to get judicial review of that decision. By way of background, the commission currently employs a team of 4 consumer mediators who resolve roughly 2,000 disputes per year, brought forward by individual consumers as informal complaints. Information about how to file an informal complaint and receive assistance from the Consumer Affairs Office, CAO, is available on our website. It's mn.gov/PUC/consumers/complaint. We can forward that to staff afterwards. We do encourage you to share this resource with your constituents. In the event that CAO is unable to satisfactorily resolve a problem on behalf of a consumer, they will refer the consumer to another agency, sometimes the Attorney General's office, the Department of Commerce, local unit of government, et cetera, or can bring the matter forward to the commission to seek a regulatory resolution. This bill would create a path and statute for individual consumers to seek commission action on matters that they do not feel were adequately resolved to their satisfaction. The amended language is structured in a way that provides for an agency decision subject to judicial review without the procedural requirements of a formal complaint which can add weeks or months to the process. As I noted earlier, the Commission does not have a position on the bill, but appreciates the opportunity to amend the bill into a form that can be administratively implemented. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm available for questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Seifert. Representative Stevenson, any additional comments before we go to questions?
No, Mr. Chair. Although we did have an offline discussion, I think the referral, the chair was correct. I should never have even questioned it for a moment, and the bill will need to go to judiciary.
I'm glad you've seen the light. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question to Representative Stevenson. Now, this bill, as I'm familiar with it, would allow individuals to come before the PUC to talk about whatever they would want. And so in my mind, this would be about a person coming forward. Would they be able to have people come on their behalf? Would individuals be able to hire a lawyer to speak on their behalf before the commission in their stead, or would they be need to do it themselves personally?
Representative Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, for that question. And I'll answer the question first and say that I certainly hope they can hire a lawyer. As a lawyer, I'm always in favor of lawyers being hired to do things. But perhaps Mr. Elwood will be able to answer that piece of it. I do want to just clarify that I think the scope of what you're imagining is a little broader than what the bill authorizes. So it's not sort of anyone who has a problem with anything related to energy or the PUC that could do this. You'd have to be in a residential customer in a specific type of dispute with your utility, like they've shut off your service wrongfully, or you think they're overcharging you on your bill. And it wouldn't encompass, you know, if you didn't like a permitting decision that the PUC made, for example. That's not this. So I'll let Mr. Elwood answer if he knows more on the lawyer side, but I sure hope the answer is yes.
Mr. Elwood. Mr. Elwood, you need to unmute.
Yeah, sorry. Mr. Chair and Representative Straczynski, first of all, this is a pretty narrow funnel that would get to the commission anyway, because first of all, it requires the consumer to first go to the utility. It then requires the consumer to go to the CAO to get that resolved. So a significant portion of consumer disputes get resolved that way, very many of them, most of them. Second of all, the issues that are typically going to be in dispute is where there is a dispute about whether or not a law, rule, tariff has been violated or has been misinterpreted. So these are a relatively narrow form. To answer your question directly, it does not preclude anybody from having a representative to help them through the process, a lawyer or anybody else. We have had cases at Legal Aid that this is why we're here in the first place, because we've had consumers, and this is all going to ultimately be involved when people are at risk of losing their essential utility service through disconnection, which we would suggest would be wrongful, or denied service in some way if they're applying and they've been denied for a wrongful reason and an alleged wrongful reason. And so anyone can have a representative help them through the process. We don't expect that many of these, but the bottom line is they would raise incredibly important issues to the commission that are most likely to be affecting not just that individual, but other ratepayers, residential ratepayers in that utility territory, and potentially every residential ratepayer across the state. So these are issues that the ones that will come to the commission are ones that really raise critically important issues that are deservedly should be heard in front of the commission. There's no opportunity to get it now, and every ratepayer in the country other than Minnesota ratepayers have that opportunity.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's maybe another follow-up to Mr. Elwood's testimony. In other states, you mentioned that this is a common practice, other places. Does it have as a narrow a funnel as you would prescribe this bill, or have you seen in other states that this funnel has gotten wider and wider and wider in other states as this goes along?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Switzinski, I actually did a research project. What I did on my summer vacation was to look at every state rules and statute, which was quite an undertaking. And I have an issue brief, which I'm happy to send to you if you have if you want some light reading. But what it does actually, they haven't really changed very much over time. These laws have been in place for a long time, and most of them they're not actually as narrow as the way we've crafted it. They basically say anybody can come to the commission with a complaint. Most of them, almost every one of them, there are a few that can bypass the informal process and go directly to the commission. We didn't change anything here with the commission's authority, the commission's processes, the requirement going to the utility first and the CAO second. We didn't change that. We also didn't change any of the commission's existing authority to simply dismiss the case if they find that there's just no merit up front. They can simply say there are no grounds to investigate any further and quickly dispose of the case. Basically, I think our bill would be a more narrow funnel in some than most of the states that I've researched all of them. So typically, this would be more narrow than many of the states that just say anybody can come.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my question is for Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson, would you agree with this statement that this bill arguably gives frustrated solar developers and rooftop solar residents a venue to bring their individual frustrations to the PUC when their projects are delayed due to inadequate grid capacity? I have a follow-up question.
Representative Stevenson.
I would not agree with that statement.
Representative Grunhagen.
Okay, and the next question is, when a person brings a concern or complaint to the PUC under this bill, if they're not satisfied with the PUC's response, can they take the step of filing litigation concerning their issue?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes. In fact, the problem that we have currently is that an individual residential consumer who brings a complaint to the PUC can't get final agency action because they can't get to the commission necessarily. And it's kind of established law, not just Minnesota law, general administrative law, that you need final agency action in order to be able to avail your rights in court. So part of the idea here is that we should give residential consumers who feel they've been wronged by their utility the opportunity to get to court through a process.
Representative Grunhagen.
Okay. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick question for Mr. Seifert. And the question would be, do you think, I know you're neutral on this bill, or the agency is, and do you think this will add substantial complaints to your agency to the point where it might be overwhelming?
Mr. Seifert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fagan, thank you for the question. We're working on a fiscal note right now to try to answer that question. I don't want to speculate. We are working with our Consumer Affairs Office. We will likely also try to do some preliminary research with other state CAOs to try to better forecast what we can expect. I do think it's reasonable to anticipate it will add some workload. But I don't think overwhelming would be a fair word to use, but it will add some workload, and we'll do our best to provide as much of an accurate assessment in the fiscal note that we put together.
Mr. Elwood, looks like you want to chime in on this as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. I appreciate the question and the concerns that are underlying it. And I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, the bill as crafted would limit the ability to go this route just to terms and conditions of service. So the kind of thing that you were concerned about would really fall outside the scope of this and would not be eligible for to go through this process. And again, I just want to emphasize that every single state has had this process in place, some for, 30, 40 years. And many of the states are the same size as we are, with the same staff, levels of the PUC, and some are much bigger, but with many more people. And in no place, nowhere, at no time, has this created an undue burden on staff or on any commission. So I don't think there's any reason to believe that it would do so here.
Thank you, Mr. Owen. I don't see any additional hands. Representative Stevenson, any closing comments to your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a good bill. I appreciate the constructive conversation today, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. And I'll just echo my support for this bill, and want to thank Mr. Elwood for bringing this forward. The fact that we're the 50th state to take this up is pretty compelling, and I think that this is narrowly focused on just a handful of issues that affect individual consumers. So with that, Representative Stevenson renews his motion that House File 3151, as amended, be re-referred to the committee, the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Aye.
Vice Chair Akam.
Aye.
Minority Leader Swazinski.
No.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Bowe.
Aye.
Representative Christensen.
Aye.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Gruenhagen.
No.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein.
Aye.
Representative Igo.
Igo, no.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Representative Lislegard. Representative Lislegard. Representative Mecklund?
Mecklund, no.
Representative Munson? Representative Munson? Representative Stevenson?
Aye.
There being 10 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred. Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we will take up House File 3337. Vice Chair Akam, since this is real short, I might just keep it. We don't have amendments.
That's all good.
All right. So this is, I will go ahead and move House File 3337 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I am authoring this bill at the request of the Department of Commerce. So I will refer it over to Mr. Kelly to explain the bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. And for the record, my name is John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. House File 337 is our energy, technical, and housekeeping bill. It has two quick changes that I'll mention here. The first is it updates 216B.096 subdivision 11 to line up with changes to the cold weather rule that were passed last session. Just changing the dates to reflect the changes from last session. And then the other change is to the due date for the Telecommunications Access Minnesota annual report. The data from T-Mobile and Sprint that the report relies on does not arrive until January 15th every year. The report in statute is due January 31st. And so it's a really tight timeline that's tough for our staff to meet. So we're asking to have the legislature move the date to March 31st. So it's just those two technical changes. And I will stop there.
So pretty straightforward. Any questions, members? Going once. All right. Seeing no questions, then I will renew my motion that House File 3337 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. Thank you so much, Mr. Kelly. Next, we will go to House File 3431. Representative Akam, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I would like to move House File 3431 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Akam moves House File 3431. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In Minnesota, last year alone, we saw our changing climate play out in extreme weather that impacts both our quality of life and our economy. We experienced severe drought and a record heat wave. It was dubbed the Summer of Smoke because of the wildfires in the western United States and Canada that dramatically impacted our air quality. And we experienced tornadoes in December, which has never happened in our state before. This year in the legislature, we're working hard to provide relief to our farmers because of the widespread drought last summer, which is important and frankly should have been done sooner. Not only do we need to react to climate-related extreme weather, but we also need to be proactive to prevent future climate damage. Last year, there were 20 separate billion-dollar weather and climate disasters in the United States. This year in Minnesota, we have a surplus and the ability to help our farmers. But what happens in the years we don't have a surplus? It seems to me we need to be planning for the future and developing strategies to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions economy-wide to prevent the worst impacts of climate change. House File 3431 is intended to give us the information we need to be proactive. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think there are some testifiers that would like to speak to the bill.
Thank you so much. I have three on my list. And do we have Mr. Frank Kolash with us?
I believe it might be Mr. Johnson from MPCA.
Mr. Tom Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'll keep my comments brief as this is not the governor's bill, and therefore we do not have an official position on this legislation. However, the agency does find the goals of this legislation very important. This type of study could help us understand the most effective emission reduction options, and that is critical to meeting our Next Generation Energy Act goals, as well as other goals that we have as a nation. It could also help us add to our knowledge of all the types of actions available across the sectors and how these emission reductions options could interact across sectors. I will also note that in the climate change subcabinet's development of the draft climate action framework, we used similar tools to evaluate how the near-term actions in the framework would impact Minnesota's emissions. And we have also used similar studies conducted for others, especially Xcel Energy and the U.S. Climate Alliance, to inform our strategies in the draft climate action framework. So in conclusion, we find that this type of study would be impactful for Minnesota. And myself and Ann Claflin are here from the agency to stand for questions if needed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Mr. Johnson, and good to see you, Ann Claflin. We next have Jamie Alexander, the Director of Project Drawdown. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Akam, Mr. Chair, for co-authoring this important bill. Bear with me. I'm going to share a few slides today to change things up a little bit. So one second while I get that set up. Okay, hopefully you can all see that. So I'm Jamie Alexander, director at Project Drawdown. We're a nonprofit organization that really exists in order to research and then communicate to the world the biggest solutions that we have to climate change. I'm joining you from Duluth, and the majority of our leadership team are all based here in the state of Minnesota. So since 2014, Project Drawdown has been one of the world's leading resources for insights and data on climate solutions. We have a research team based around the world who study and model out the climate solutions that the world already has today. So what they cost to deploy, how much they'll save us over time compared to our business as usual approaches, and then how much of the, you know, kind of planet warming greenhouse gas emissions these solutions will reduce or avoid. So in 2017, we published a book of our initial findings. This was really the world's first ever effort to aggregate the climate solutions that we already have in one place. This book became a New York Times bestseller. It really resonated with governments, businesses, communities, and individuals. And our research showed and continues to show that the technologies and practices that we have today are sufficient if they're contextualized and scaled. They're sufficient to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the level that the science calls for. However, the data and insights that we have are global in nature. This that you see here is a depiction of the way we categorize climate solutions, sort of at the highest level of categorization. But in order to make this data and these insights actionable and to get capital and appropriate policy in place and jobs in the right sectors, we need to identify the strategies that are right for a given place. So, you know, given our natural resources here in the state of Minnesota, our job skills, the industries here, et cetera, you know, these solutions will vary widely, as will the greenhouse gas reduction strategies. And that's why we at Project Drawdown are very supportive of this bill. I want to start with a really quick illustration of how we think about climate solutions. So if you imagine that this rectangle here is the atmosphere, so this is the amount of heat-trapping gases that humans put into the atmosphere every year. The left side of this diagram is where these greenhouse gases come from, again, on a global scale. So this is, you know, electricity production, food, agriculture, and land use, industry, transportation, buildings. Again, this is global data. It's different at a, you know, at a local and state level, and the strategies will be different. So the transportation sector, for example, globally is the fourth biggest emitting sector, but in the U.S., it is the biggest emitting sector. So this is the you know, the broad sectors in terms of their emissions, but thankfully, we also have sinks, so what we call natural sinks that absorb carbon at land and at sea. So with all of those inputs, all of the emissions that humans are putting into the atmosphere, and then everything that nature takes out of the atmosphere, we still have about 60% of those heat-trapping gases left, and that's what creates this thick blanket around the planet and what is leading to climate change. So knowing where those gases come from and where they go helps us to identify climate solutions. This is, you know, this kind of shows where the solutions are as we've analyzed them. This is, again, at the highest categorization level, and then you can double-click in each of these. But we can displace the old and, you know, high-emitting ways of doing things by replacing them with climate solutions, like transforming our energy system to one that primarily uses renewable energy, rooftop solar, you know, electrifying our buildings, solutions for how we grow our food. This is a practice known as managed grazing, regenerative agriculture, where the soil actually absorbs carbon, you know, how we deal with our waste, creating more bikeable, walkable, and connected cities. How we power our commercial buildings and how we exist in relationship with nature, you know, by supporting and enhancing our natural ecosystems. And I want to also say that, you know, the financial case for investing in climate solutions is crystal clear. The savings significantly outweigh costs. So Project Drawdown has analyzed the financial implications of scaling climate solutions. How much do they cost? How much do they save when compared with the status quo technology or practice that it replaces? Overall, net operational savings exceed net implementation costs about five times over. And if we consider the monetary value of co-benefits, like healthcare savings from reduced air pollution or avoided climate damages, the financial case becomes even stronger. And again, this is at a global level. So this picture will be different here in the state of Minnesota, which provides the rationale for this study. And I am going to stop sharing my screen now, because that is, you know, that's sort of the limit of our global insights on climate solutions. We have the global data and global strategies to reduce greenhouse gases. We know where emissions come from. We have the solutions to transition toward climate solutions. But what we don't have and what the world needs now is, you know, particularly in light of yesterday's IPCC report and the urgency that was yet again underscored, we need contextualized state-level strategies to make all of this global data hyper-relevant and laser-focused. We need that for a few reasons. So one, governments around the world are looking to reduce their emissions faster, and we need transparency. We need to build trust between governments and companies and citizens so that we can all be part of the same process. So here in Minnesota, you know, we have companies like General Mills, 3M, Target, and others who are major contributors to greenhouse gas emissions. And if there were, you know, state-level strategies that they could flow into, it would greatly accelerate their work and, you know, help build trust and transparency with governments and citizens. Second, coalescing around shared priorities. Here in Duluth, where I'm based as one example, we have two separate climate efforts happening. One is citizen-led and one is led by the city. And we're using different data, so that makes coordination challenging. So given, you know, sort of this vanishing window of time that we have to act, we need to all start coalescing around shared priorities and shared strategies. And it's hard to do that if we don't have clear baselines, data, and sort of a shared set of North Stars that we're moving toward. And then lastly, you know, the reason that we're so excited about, you know, about this bill is getting capital to the most effective climate solutions and strategies for a given place. This report will help guide investors and philanthropies, including corporate philanthropies, to be able to bring their capital to bear as well, and help bring more funding into the space for critical climate solutions for the state of Minnesota. So I'll just end by saying, you know, we have the solutions at hand, and this report will provide a critical missing link between global strategies and state level ones. So thank you for the time.
Thank you so much for being with us. And our final speaker before we turn to member questions is Chris Connery with the 100% campaign.
Chair Long and members of the committee, my name is Chris Connery. I'm the director of the 100% campaign. We're a coalition of almost 60 organizations who are advocating for an equitable and clean energy future in Minnesota. We bring together faith leaders, labor unions, health professionals, scientists, youth, environmental advocates, community organizations, new Americans, indigenous leaders, rural organizations, artists, and small business owners. I'm here today to share our support for House File 3431. We're excited about it for three reasons. First, Minnesota needs a plan. As the committee is well aware, our state is not on track to meet our bipartisan goal set in 2007 of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions 80% economy-wide by 2050. A plan like this, these strategies, would help us get back on track by making sure we're hitting key benchmarks along the way, like America's commitment in the Paris Agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50 to 52% by 2030. Second, public planning is a way to bring people together. As you heard Mr. Johnson describe, the state is well positioned to bring together a wide range of stakeholders with the knowledge and expertise that we need to create a plan together. All of these plans, how we generate electricity, how we build, travel, or farm, will be made over the next 10 years through either our inaction or our action, either in public or behind closed doors. And this bill's approach would help ensure that these decisions get made together by all the impacted stakeholders. Third, all of these strategies could bring tangible co-benefits to Minnesotans. That's a key reason why a multi-stakeholder public plan is the right approach. We could meet our state and national goals in a way that lowers energy costs, builds better buildings, creates healthier soil, protects our air and water, reduces racial and gender disparities, improves public health, and creates good jobs. Our endorsing organizations and their members support this approach because we get it. A transition to an equitable and clean energy future is an opportunity, and this bill is an opportunity, is an important way to make sure we don't let this opportunity pass us by. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Mr. Connery. Well, I'll begin. I have about one question for Ms. Alexander. And I think, laid out really effectively the range of options that there are for taking a look at what we can do for the various sectors of climate change. I'm a pretty big fan of your work. I've got the drawdown book as my desk book in my office. You know, we're lucky to have you all here in Minnesota doing work internationally, but based here. The question I have is on the importance of planning. We know right now where we're at as a state. The PCA does excellent work in measuring our progress towards our goals, and we know that we're off track. And I'm just curious if there are other jurisdictions that you're familiar with, states or national governments that have come up with a plan, and how that's changed the conversation in those states, or if it's driven action.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's a great question. So we have worked with a few other states who have worked to implement a similar strategy. There's not been legislation in place, however, to guide these. So when I reached out to the state of Georgia, for example, who put together an effort called Drawdown Georgia to look at the most important, you know, ways that the state of Georgia can move climate solutions forward and reduce their emissions. That happened, you know, with researchers at their local universities, primarily, and they're envious that this is something that, you know, that's being considered at the state level. But that has been a very successful effort for them. They've looked at, you know, the specifics of the landscape of, you know, the state of Georgia. What do they have at, you know, what are their natural resources? What is their geography? What are their people skilled to do? What are their industries? And so they've really taken that and turned that into a statewide strategy that has been taken up by universities, businesses, faith groups, the local, you know, local organizations have all rallied around this one shared plan. And I think that has really helped them be able to coalesce. And they've reported that it's accelerated their progress. It's brought needed investment from the private sector as well, and really helped, you know, align the community around a shared set of goals.
That's fantastic to hear. Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Madam Alexandra. You know, on your slides, it looked like you had a total estimated cost of implementing would be a plan in this book, would be $28 trillion. Do you have a cost rundown of what your estimates would be, just if the United States would move it forward, what would the costs to be here in the United States? And then if more like it just in the state of Minnesota, and then I have a follow-up.
Ms. Alexander.
Yes, so all of our data is global. So those figures are global. We modeled out two different scenarios. One is, you know, the world invests rapidly and at scale, you know, to accelerate all those climate solutions very ambitiously, and that's meeting a 1.5C degree target. And that would have us sort of achieving what we call drawdown in the mid-2040s. But those numbers are global. So again, we have not done the work of looking at a national level or a state level, which again is what, you know, why I think that this study is so important to be able to provide, you know, to fill that needed gap. And then the second scenario we modeled out was a 2-degree scenario. And we have, you know, a different set of figures for that, but the figures that you saw were aligned with a 1.5-degree scenario.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just obviously I haven't read the book, and maybe if I'm on vacation or something, I'll have a chance to pick it up. But so 1.5 Celsius would cost us $28 trillion estimated globally. Would, if we were able to lower that by 1.8 Celsius, would that stop global warming?
Stopping limiting warming to a certain temperature increase is the way we look at it. That would not stop the effects of climate change that we're already seeing, but it would stop, you know, what we work toward is when the amount of the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere stops accelerating and starts to decline. That's the point that we're working toward, where we stop making the problem worse. Right now, we're still digging ourselves into a hole. Stopping climate change, you know, we won't stop the climate impacts from happening, but we can limit limit temperature increase. Our goal is to limit temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which would prevent these cascading negative climate impacts from getting worse.
And I'll just note the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that came out yesterday was a comparison to a 2 degree warming scenario versus a modest degree. I think it was a 0.25 or something degree warming scenario, and the differences there are huge. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So yeah, my question is for Ms. Alexander as well. And I guess, so we're looking at that, all that data globally. And my question was more or less focusing on, we're talking a lot about how, the United States can be leaders. We're going to cut emissions here. How does all this formulate though, not trusting countries like Russia and China to even cut emissions? And if I'm correct, the climate accord or the Paris Climate Accord means the Chinese agreed that they don't even have to start drawing down their carbon until 2030. So for the next 8 years, they're going to keep emitting more and more and more, yet we'll keep cutting down. So at the end game of this, how does that factor into all your math? Because I don't see the countries of Russia or China doing anything to get along in the global playground right now and do their part.
Ms. Alexander.
Thank you for the question. We look at it from the, the opportunity that these solutions represent. So the amount of jobs that these solutions will create in new sectors where, workers can be transitioned into them, the amount of savings that we'll see compared to, our current technologies that these solutions will replace, will, provide good paying jobs. They'll provide return on investment over time. And they'll, help contribute to less climate damages over the longer term. So we look at it from the opportunity inherent in investing in and scaling and getting policy in place to accelerate the deployment of those solutions, because it's a tremendous opportunity for states and for the United States to move boldly in that direction. But we haven't looked, and again, so this data is all global. It's not looking at what other countries are going to do or what their share is. It's looking at it from, the opportunity inherent in it.
Representative, I'll follow up.
Yeah. So, I mean, that didn't really, I guess, answer my question. My concern here is we're already seeing it right now. The United States is having to import oil from Russia, a country that is going to war and causing problems. The issue I have here with this plan is that we're going to see mandates and proposals that are going to cost more to everyday Minnesotans and Americans. Meanwhile, the rest of the world is going to have cheaper energy and become superpowers and leave us behind. I'm really concerned that we need to think about how we talk about other countries. We can't just talk about goodwill and giving hugs and patting each other on the back and saying it's going to feel good. That's not going to make things better. We need to think about this globally and how there is bad actors out there. Thank you.
Sounds like a pretty good case for moving off of foreign oil. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is also for Ms. Alexander. So I'm particularly interested in the potential for climate mitigation in the land space, moving towards regenerative agriculture, maximizing forest, protecting wetlands, peatlands, et cetera. But it seems like whenever we're in this conversation, the question of land use change comes up and the impact that changes may have, not just within Minnesota, but globally. And it seems like there's also some, not always consensus about how to measure that. So I'm curious how Project Drawdown measures land use change, and if you could talk a little bit about the different options that you've chosen among.
Ms. Alexander.
Thank you for the question. We look at the land use, so we've kind of bundled the food, agriculture, and land use into one sector, which actually, when you combine all of them, it's equivalent in terms of emissions with the energy sector. So we look at it from, a number of different areas. So one third of the world's food is wasted, food waste. So that means that the energy that went into producing that food and transporting that food is, you know, what was for naught. So that, so we look at both, you know, we need to address food waste so that we are more efficient with what we're growing. We look at approaches to, you know, to growing food more sustainably. And that's things like regenerative agriculture or tree intercropping, mixing, you know, different kinds of managed grazing on farmland. And then we look at, you know, how we restore and protect our land. So we bundle those three things together as they're very interrelated in terms of climate solutions. We have not looked at specifically at land use change. I think your question is around around land use change. It's not something that we've looked at or have a specific approach to, but more sort of looking at, you know, on a global scale, what the solutions are. And my sense is that this report will provide important insights about what works in Minnesota, what has been tried, what hasn't, you know, what are the strategies that are relevant here, given our, you know, our natural resources and landscapes and what our farmers are already doing. So I think that's, you know, that to me, that shows the value of a report like this.
Representative Lippert, any follow-up?
That's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I have a question for Representative Akam. I just want to give you a little pushback as far as California and the forest fires. I happen to have a couple of acquaintances who have relatives out there. And just quickly, when I was in the Marine Corps in 71-73, on the base I was at, they would typically have fires every once in a while, but they were able to bulldoze fire breaks at that time, and therefore the fire was contained and easily put out. Today, subject to the environmentalist changes in regulations, they can't do fire breaks anymore out in California. The result is it's not climate change, it's poor management of the forest quality that is destroying out there. In fact, we burnt a whole town down, Paradise, California, with this nonsense. And so that's the problem. It's not climate change, and I would just encourage you to research that. Then I have a quick question for Jamie Alexander. Mr. Chair.
Sure, proceed.
Okay, yeah. The question is this, I just would encourage you to do research on greenhouse gases. The greenhouse gases that damage our environment is connected to methane, according to my experts. And we get a lot of that from landfills. More CO2 is not actually bad for our Earth, it's actually good. And there is over 31,000 scientists, U.S. scientists, who aren't tax subsidized that signed a petition back in the 90s stating that. So I think we're going in the wrong direction, and we should be addressing incinerators in our landfills to actually address the methane that's causing a problem. Please research that and reassess your thinking. The other thing, when you have experts that give information to you about CO2, ask yourself, are they tax subsidized? In other words, are they getting tax dollars to come up with those conclusions? It does affect human nature, okay? So just appreciate any response you would have. Thank you.
And it's Ms. Alexander.
Thank you for the question. So we look at greenhouse gases, which include, of course, methane. Methane is one of the most potent greenhouse gases, and it's one of the things that we have identified we need to address quickly. And it's the lowest hanging fruit, absolutely. Many of our solutions address that in the end through looking at waste, including food waste, as you mentioned, in landfills. There are other greenhouse gases in addition to methane that are less potent but also contribute to climate change, including CO2. And so we look at the full mix of greenhouse gases. I appreciate appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up.
Yes, quick follow-up, Representative Bruning.
Okay, thank you for that response, Ms. Alexander. You know, I had a Democrat on the House floor from up in northern Minnesota state to me that when trees are die and decay, they're giving off a lot of so-called greenhouse gases. And yet we are pursuing in Minnesota a direction where we don't clean those things up. And the result is we create more of a fire hazard, just like we had this last year. So we're going down the same path as California, and we're making a mess of this rather than addressing what the real problem is. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please think that through and do some research.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is also for Ms. Alexander. Ms. Alexander, first of all, thank you. I think your work is inspiring and helpful. I think it gives us some very concrete strategies to, you know, really figure out how we, you know, get to 1.5. So I'm interested in, you had mentioned that transportation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, you know, in the United States and I believe in Minnesota as well. So what is your advice about, you know, the best ways we can cut the greenhouse gases in the transportation sector? Obviously, we have transit and land use issues and electrification, but what rises to the top for you and what would you advise us in the legislature on that?
Ms. Alexander.
Thank you for the question. So we look at transportation from a few different kind of broad areas. One is, you know, shifting to alternatives. So we look at, you know, creating, you know, high speed rail and electrifying electrifying rail and, you know, creating more walkability in our cities, bike lanes, things like that. So one is kind of, shifting to alternatives and creating infrastructure in our cities that enables those transitions to other forms of transportation. Another is, you know, looking at making more efficient the vehicles that are on the road. So that's looking at, you know, more efficient cars, trucks, aviation, and then ultimately, you know, switching to electric, looking at the infrastructure for enabling that with charging stations. And then, you know, less demand for travel as well. So a lot of the corporations that I work with, you know, coming out of the pandemic are, you know, reducing their business travel is a big aspect of how they can reduce their overall emissions. And so we sort of look at it from the, yes, electric vehicles tends to be the main thing that that most people think of when they think of decarbonizing the transportation sector. We look at it from a bit of a broader view where, you know, relying less on personally owned vehicles if we can and where we can, and creating more kind of equitable and accessible ways of getting around cities and infrastructure for cities. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Alexander. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be for Ms. Alexander as well. I know that we're focused on reducing harmful emissions in the state of Minnesota, but you know, we share the air with the rest of the world. And you know, much of what I've been working on in the energy committees is directing our attention to this idea that we're reducing emissions here in the state, but we're actually shifting the burden to developing nations around the world because they use such enormous amounts of energy produced in a pretty dirty way to mine, process, and manufacture many of these products that we're using, like electric car batteries and the you know, turbine blades and solar panels and such overseas. If we're going to be looking at these options for reducing emissions, is there an idea? Do you have an opinion on whether or not we should even consider looking at the increase in emissions from all of this mining and processing of these materials overseas that we're shifting?
Ms. Alexander.
Thank you for the question. I think there are different ways of sort of slicing and dicing the data that underpins these, you know, the climate solutions that we've looked at. You know, one is, and I Absolutely, you're raising a very important point that many of these climate solutions have adverse impacts. As of now, you know, internal combustion engines are still far more contribute far more to climate change than electric vehicles. But you're absolutely right that they bring their own set of problems. So we sort of look at different configurations of climate solutions. So you can sort of whittle down the list to those that are, you know, that have positive health impacts. So you can look at the intersection of poverty alleviation and climate solutions in developing countries, or positive health outcomes and climate solutions. You can look at, you know, kind of different configurations of them depending on what's most important. But I think it's very, you know, and you're raising, you know, the good point around, you know, around electric vehicles, which is why also taking another look at city infrastructure so that we can ultimately rely less on personally owned vehicles is a critical part of the mix, and why I think a report like this is so foundational to our climate strategy here in the state of Minnesota.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just have a follow up comment.
Yes, briefly, Representative. Yeah.
Thank you for your comments, Ms. Alexander. And I mean, I like the idea of moving forward to reduce harmful emissions, but I just saw yesterday that there was a 7-month study of a power plant in North Carolina talking about like the nitrogen oxide emissions because they've increased due to solar, right? Because every time you put solar on the grid, you have to have an emergency backup generation of electricity that can come on every time a cloud comes overhead, and the emissions from these inefficient power plants are actually emitting more harmful emissions than if we just stuck with a high efficiency, you know, load based natural gas plant. And so, basically, what this study shows is that adding solar to the grid is worse for the environment here locally, not to mention all the extra energy consumed and produced overseas when these products are manufactured. So I hope that I like the idea of doing a study, but I'm certainly not going to vote for this one, especially with the administration and its focus on pushing green energy. But I hope to continue the conversation.
Thank you, Representative Munson. Representative Ball.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a question, more just a comment for Ms. Alexander. You know, when Representative Grunhagen was speaking a few minutes ago, you had made a comment that there are, you know, many different greenhouse gases, and certainly there are, but we have to remember that all greenhouse gases are not created equal, and methane is much more aggressive than CO2, for example. So we need to keep that in mind when we're looking at the different issues that are out there, different forms that are out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ball, and I think Ms. Alexander made that point in her response. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question, Ms. Alexander. In the book, I guess I read an article just the other day that talked about, from a copper mining standpoint, that in what we've used so far as copper, we've mined in the last 500 years, and we'll need just as much if this is to move forward in the next 25 as we did the last 500. Are there any solutions in the book on how about like that copper mining and just base mineral acquisition could move forward?
Ms. Alexander.
Thank you for the question. Unfortunately, that is beyond the scope of our research, but I wonder if anyone else that has joined today would have a better answer for that.
I'll take a crack at that. I know that that the Biden administration just this week came out with a study looking at supply chain and critical minerals, and so perhaps I can share that with the committee.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Swazinski.
Just before we kind of move on, and maybe it's already been stated, but the idea that the Biden administration would laugh off the cost of oil right now as far as the impacts on family budgets and not look at, you know, opening up areas for exploration and stopping his stonewalling of permitting for oil exploration in the United States, it really should be condemned bipartisanly across the country. So just let that be said.
We're getting a little far afield from Representative Akam's bill, but I'll allow it. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another question for Ms. Alexander, please. So in the discussion, which has been great today, there's clearly no silver bullet for climate solutions. It needs to be multifaceted. I really support this report so we can get more information and have a roadmap. My question to you today is, could you tell me in studies you've done, how impactful would a carbon fee and dividend bill be in the range of solutions for this issue?
Ms. Alexander, this is also a little far afield from Representative Akam's bill, but I'll allow it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the question. Certainly, you know, policy mechanisms like a carbon fee and dividend are important ways of scaling climate solutions. So I think we, you know, our bread and butter is the what. So what are the solutions and how quickly do they need to be scaled and the data surrounding that? And then you're getting at the question of how do we reduce the barriers to bringing them into the world? How do we accelerate them? How do we ensure they're equitable? And so that, you know, so policy change is a huge lever, you know, getting capital to the right climate solutions to farmers and startups and communities and the people that are, you know, actually scaling climate solutions in the world. There's, you know, behavior change is an important leverage point. Creating jobs. So I think, we haven't looked at in our analysis when we modeled out how much we need to invest in climate solutions and how quickly that we would achieve our targets. We did include a carbon tax as one if we had a price on carbon. What would that mean in terms of accelerating it? There are some other great tools. MIT, I think, has a great tool that enables you to see how quickly different solutions scale with different policy mechanisms in place. I think it's called En-ROADS. But that's a great question. We haven't evaluated specifically how the numbers would change with a carbon fee and dividend, but recognize policy as an important lever.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Alexander, thanks for being here today. A lot of good answers to the questions. Thank you.
Representative Igo, real brief, and then we got to move on to our final bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick comment, and then my question is also very quick. Representative Bierman, I have your silver bullet. It's northeastern Minnesota on the Iron Range. Copper and nickel everywhere. We can build all this stuff right here in Minnesota. There's your silver bullet. So I got some bills I'll send you where you can sign on to. My question for you, Ms. Alexander, is carbon sequestration talked about in your book or any of these studies? Because if so, I think that's maybe something we should look into. And I'm actually carrying a bill right now that I've applied for a hearing in this committee, Mr. Chair. So if that is a solution that's part of this, maybe we should be talking about that in a future committee.
Ms. Alexander.
Yes, great question. We looked at natural carbon sequestration, which happens at in forests and mangroves and peat bogs and then the ocean, and then we did look at human at carbon sequestration strategies, carbon capture and things like that. We have not yet seen that they have shown the return on investment. We include them because they meet our criteria for they have the potential to reduce or avoid greenhouse gas emissions at a certain level. They're feasible. They're ready to deploy. But we haven't yet seen, at least in our analysis, we haven't yet seen kind of the return on investment or the effectiveness of carbon capture, human made as opposed to natural climate solutions that do the work as well. But definitely, something that we recognize we need to reduce emissions and we will eventually need to rely on some level of carbon sequestration technology.
Representative Akam, would you care to make any closing remarks to your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for the robust conversation today. I just want to say that I think that I was happy to hear that so many of my colleagues recognize the importance of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and So a bill like this will be very beneficial. And really the point that I want to get across is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And Ms. Alexander talked about the economics of reducing emissions versus responding to some of the extreme weather events and the crises that we've had across our country and across the globe. So anyway, I appreciate the support today. Thank you so much for hearing.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Representative Akam renews her motion that House File 3431 be laid over, and the bill is laid over. The final bill on our agenda for today is House File 2234. Representative Bowe's bill will be heard informationally. We didn't hear the bill last year, but we had this listed on our electric vehicle day and unfortunately ran out of time. But this will be an important bill for consideration in our omnibus bill this year. And so I wanted to give Representative Bowe a chance to remind us about his bill. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will be quick since it is an informational hearing only, but House File 2234 seeks to offer EV charging station infrastructure at county government centers in Minnesota. Over these last months and actually a year or two, several counties have expressed an interest to me in providing EV charging infrastructure for their customers at their government center locations. Many have said they're unable to afford to do it on their own. Others have expressed a frustration in applying for grants through the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, but not being successful in receiving those grants. In greater Minnesota, government centers are frequently located adjacent to residential neighborhoods. And that means that the same infrastructure could be used by customers during the day when they come into the government center to get permits, to go to county commissioner meetings, to see their public health nurses. And then in the evening, both by neighbors who live nearby and also county fleet vehicles overnight. And this would allow counties to include EVs in their stable of fleet vehicles. So that's why I'm excited about this bill. I think it helps to get EV charging infrastructure out to the people, out to regular folks in greater Minnesota. I did have an author's amendment last year that sought to provide some flexibility for smaller counties who might not be able to be up to owning and managing and collecting fees from that infrastructure. But I think subdivision 2, paragraph 2 really addresses that issue. So we should be good, I think, this year with that. I have had some conversations wanting to look at maybe addressing handicap access concerns. So there may be an author's amendment when this moves forward. But this bill does seek $4.1 million from the renewable development account, and I think it's a good use. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bowe. And I'll just note, I had an email recently from County Commissioner Molly Malone from Murray County in support of your bill. And she mentioned that her county has 8,000 people and doesn't even have a stoplight, but that there are a number of tourists who come through in the summer, and she sees quite a number of electric vehicles coming through and is concerned that right now they don't have EV charging stations available in their counties. You've got support from across the state for your proposal. Any questions for Representative Bowe? All right, well, Representative Bowe, thank you so much for reminding us about your bill and for flagging the potential amendments should we include it in our omnibus bill. Members, thank you for the robust discussion today. That's all of our business, and we are adjourned.